my Keurig brewer from Walmart always comes in super clutch. I got it so I can keep grinding on my paper. You know I'm hitting that deadline. I also got it so I could stay up late to do some exam cramming. And of course, you know I'll be ready to stroll into my morning class, sipping in style. I guess you could say it's a literal lifesaver. Cheers to that. Shop your coffee fuel needs at Walmart.
It's time to have your high five moment with High Five Casino, the top social casino where the action and real prizes never stop. Fun spins and big wins are right at your fingertips with over 1,000 games, including High Five Casino exclusives. High Five Casino is always free to play with free coins given out every 4 hours. Sign up today and get free welcome coins you can spin for a chance at cash prizes. Visit highfivecasino.com.
High Five Casino.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. Must be 21 years or older. Terms and conditions apply.
Summer is supposed to be an opportunity to slow down. But when you look at your kids, you can't help but notice that your kids are growing up fast. Help them build independence as they grow with Greenlight. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families where parents can keep an eye on kids' money habits while kids learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely. It's the easy, convenient way to raise financially smart kids. Get your first month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
At Ashley, you'll find colorful furniture that brings your home to life. Ashley makes it easier than ever to express your personal style with an array of looks in fun trending hues to choose from earth tones to vibrant colors to calming blues and greens. Ashley has pieces for every room in the house in the season's most sought-after shades. A more colorful life starts at Ashley. Shop in-store, online today. Ashley, for the love of home.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. It's a case that has stumped generations of detectives and internet sleuths. On September 16th, 2009, 24-year-old Matrice Richardson was arrested at an Oceanside Malibu restaurant and taken to Malibu Lost Hills Sheriff's Station. With no money, no phone, and no ride, and in the midst of what was later described by law enforcement as a severe bipolar episode, Richardson was released by the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department just after midnight and disappeared into the night. Her whereabouts confounded authorities for nearly a year, until her skeletonized and partially mummified remains were found on August 9, 2010, up rugged Dark Canyon, some 6 miles away from the station. There was no sign of trauma to Matrice's remains, and the coroner could not determine the cause of death. But Matrice's death was undoubtedly suspicious. Her bra, belt, and jeans were found some distance from her body. The rest of her clothing was never found, and investigators never recovered a tiny bone called the hyoid, which often breaks when a person is strangled. A tenacious reporter and gifted storyteller, Dana Goodyear spent the past 5 years on the case, leading her and her co-reporter, Haley Fox, to the secluded, tight-knit mountain community of Montanito, where Matrice was last seen. Driven by conversations with Richardson's grieving friends and family, and undeterred by the scant clues that have been picked through by dozens of previous investigations, Lost Hills, Dark Canyon probes where others have not, including Richardson's never-before-seen personal journals, new eyewitness interviews, and new potential forensic evidence. In 12 gripping episodes, Goodyear painstakingly builds a case that Matrice's death involved foul play, and she identifies a potential suspect. The true crime podcast that we are featuring this evening is Lost Hills, Dark Canyon, Season 4, with my special guest, journalist, author, writer, and host of the Lost Hills podcast, Dana Goodyear. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Dana Goodyear.
Thank you so much for your interest and for having me on.
Thank you so much. Now, before I have you take us back to September 16th, 2009, and Matrice Richardson and Joffrey's restaurant, and why police were called in the first place, tell us how and why you came to be involved with this case and this story.
Well, I heard about Matrice's disappearance when it happened. I was living in Los Angeles, and I read about it with horror and just kind of bafflement, like so many other people. I did not imagine that her story would come to consume my life in the way that it did many, many years later. At the time, I was writing for The New Yorker full time, and I was writing poetry, and I had deep interest in crime stories and true crime stories, but I hadn't yet become a teller of them. And I don't think podcasts existed. So the way that I got involved with Matrice's story is that in 2018, I started investigating a story in Malibu, a horrible story of a young father who was camping with his two-year-old and four-year-old daughters in Malibu Creek State Park, and he was inexplicably shot in the head at 4 a.m. And there were no suspects initially, and there was a great outcry in Malibu, and it was obviously a terrible tragedy. And as I began to learn more about that story and report it out and learn that there had been many incidents of shootings that had been happening in and around that campground and in Malibu Canyon, which runs alongside one side of the campground that hadn't been reported to the public, I started hearing from people in the community that they thought there could be a connection to Matrice Richardson, because her case, her disappearance in 2009 and the discovery of her remains in 2010 had left people very unsatisfied. They had no answers as to what had really happened to her. And the story that law enforcement put out there also really didn't make sense, in the same way that there were many problems with the story of the shooting in Malibu Creek State Park. So people started to wonder, you know, could the same person who killed this father in the campground, Tristan Baudette, could he have harmed, he or she have harmed Matrice? And that did not turn out to be the case, as my reporting would show, but that was initially how I started reporting on Matrice. I was really reporting on a different murder. And everywhere I went, people wanted to talk about Matrice Richardson. So it took years of developing sources in Malibu to feel that I could do justice to her story and bring something new to her story, because it's been told many times before, but there's a kind of built-in limitation to a lot of the other reporting, which is that they just couldn't progress beyond what the law enforcement had said, even though that clearly was unsatisfactory. And I just got extremely lucky in being able to, with my reporting partner, who's also a senior producer on the show, Haley Fox, unpeel some of those layers and go deeper with the story.
For those that don't know this story, can you give us the basic outline of that September 16, 2009, and Matrice Richardson is at a high-end, for better lack of a term, the celebrity-type restaurant. Tell us what happens.
Yeah, so Joffrey's of Malibu is this kind of celebrity clubhouse type of place on Pacific Coast Highway. It's very beautiful. There are, you know, those kind of fairy lights hanging from the trees. It's very lush. There's plants everywhere. You're sort of hanging off the side of a cliff overlooking the Pacific Ocean. And it's a very romantic spot. And it's been around forever. And it has this devoted clientele of locals and some of them celebrities and tourists. And nobody really knows why Matrice showed up there that night, but she did. And she wasn't from Malibu. She loved the ocean and she loved to drive by the ocean. So some people in the circle of her friends and family speculated that maybe she was just taking a drive by the ocean. And she told law enforcement later that night that she responded to those lights that she saw outside the restaurant. And so she pulled in, and Maitrice was 24 years old, very beautiful, very charming, very delightful human being from everything I've ever heard about her. A Black woman who was a recent graduate of Cal State Fullerton and was on her way to, she was in the process of applying to graduate school for clinical psychology. So she wanted to become a psychologist, and she showed up at Joffrey's and she was by herself, and she was acting strange, but not in a threatening way at all. She went and sat down with a large party of people, was chatting with them and saying some kind of a little bit off the wall things that they didn't really understand, but they didn't mind her sitting there because she was pretty entertaining. And then she ordered dinner and ended up leaving the restaurant without paying her bill. So the staff at Joffrey's called 911 saying, "We don't really know what to do. We're a little concerned about her. We don't know. She's been saying some strange things and acting a little strange, and we don't know if she's okay. So can you help us out?" And so deputies from Lost Hills Station, which is the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department's station that's out there and covers Malibu and Calabasas and some other communities, those deputies responded, and they decided to give her a field sobriety test, and she passed. She wasn't drunk, it turned out. They did find some marijuana in her car, which at that point was illegal. It was less than an ounce, but it was not legal at that point. That's a misdemeanor at that point. And then they just felt like something was off about her. And they said to the Joffrey staff, "You know, if you want us to take her with us, we have to execute a citizen's arrest for you." And so they did that. And so she was charged with the marijuana misdemeanor, but also with another misdemeanor, which was quote unquote defrauding an innkeeper for the failure to pay the bill. And they took her to Lost Hills Station, which is pretty far distance actually from Joffrey's. So you have to drive all the way through Malibu Canyon and over basically to where the 101 highway is for Californians. So I want to let you jump in if you have more questions, and I can tell you next what happened when she was at the station.
Well, let's find out what happens at the station, but we skipped over that the restaurant really just wants this bill to be paid. And so Maitrice contacts someone about that bill that night.
Well, she did try calling her great grandmother, who she sort of on and off. She lived with, you know, she technically lived with her great grandmother at that point, but she was kind of a free spirit who had a lot of friends and a lot of girlfriends. She was gay and she would sleep in different places. And she was actually, it turned out, sleeping in her car a lot at that point too. But they called her great grandmother and said, "You know, can you come out and pay her bill?" And her great grandmother was 91 years old and said, I can't come to Malibu." And they wouldn't accept. They had a policy apparently of not accepting a credit card over the phone. And they said she would have to fax it, and she didn't have a fax machine. So there were a lot of barriers to resolving the issue. You know, it, according to Maitrice's dad, one of the most painful ironies of this moment is that he later discovered that not only was her wallet in her car, but he said there was a bank card linked to an account with thousands of dollars in it. So it wasn't that she couldn't pay. It's just that she didn't have the presence of mind right then to be able to execute that payment. And so they took her to the station.
Now they take her to the station. Tell us about the phone call with her mother and police.
So during the time while deputies were talking to various people at the restaurant and doing the field sobriety test and searching Maitrice's car, the conversation among her family members was happening. And so her mother found out that she had been was on her way to the station, and while she was in transit, she had a conversation with the deputy who answered the phone at Lost Hill Station about saying, basically, look, if you're going to keep her overnight, I won't come out there. She lived about an hour away, and she had a 10 or 11 year old daughter at home, my Teresa's little half sister. I'd really rather just come in the morning. If you're going to keep her all night, I don't need to go out there and sit there in the lobby waiting for her to be released. But if you're going to release her, I'd love, you know, I don't want her wandering around. She doesn't know the area and she doesn't have friends out there. And she, I'm paraphrasing, but that could be dangerous. And she actually said something that's so haunting to hear. She said,
yes,
I'd hate to wake up in the morning and hear the report, girl found somewhere with her head chopped off.
Wow.
And the deputy reassured her, you know, no, she'll be fine. She'll be safe here. And then in the event that she was taken to the station, she was given all the live scan, background check, check for outstanding warrants, all the things that happen when you are hard booked. And then at a little past midnight, she was told by the jailer that she was free to go. And that is technically, you know, the legal obligation of law enforcement. You know, otherwise there could have been a claim of over detention. But it's very unfortunate that someone there at this very small station where there were not very many other people in custody that night didn't think to call her mother back and say, actually, we are going to release her. So the other thing that happened was that my Teresa's phone had been impounded in her car, which was all the way back near Pacific Coast Highway, you know, about 12 miles from the station. And she had no ride. So she didn't have money to pay for a cab. She didn't have a phone to call a friend or to be tracked by anyone. And she left the station. She left Lost Hill Station around 12:25 a.m. And nobody knows how she got from there to where she was next seen at 6:30 approximately the next morning. But that 6:30 a.m. sighting the next morning was for a long time the kind of the last known sighting of her.
Her mother calls back at, you say, after 5 a.m., expecting that she thought she had some agreement with the police and that they would keep her in custody till she got there in the morning. So incredibly, in this podcast, you have the interview, the conversation with the police again, and then later the missing, trying to file a missing persons report on behalf of her daughter. Incredible.
Well, lucky for us, a lot of these calls were published on the internet because there was so much outrage nationwide, but especially in California, I would think about how she was released and whether this was a safe or ethical, forget legal, it was a legal release, but was it the right thing to do? I don't think anyone would argue that at this point. My Teresa's mother, Latice Sutton, finds out that her daughter has been released and she's terrified. And then as it happened, the place where my Teresa was seen at 6:30 in the morning is this small community of Montanito, which is kind of halfway back to approximately where my Teresa's car was. So you could sort of imagine maybe she walked back there, or maybe someone gave her a ride, somebody who's never come forward. We really don't know how she got to Montanito. She had 6 hours to walk about 6 miles. So it is possible, of course, that she did it on foot. But her mother felt that that was very unlikely, just given her general habits. I guess, should we say now what was becoming apparent to people in law enforcement and her family? We're starting to talk about the fact that my Teresa was not well mentally, and she had gone to Joffrey's in the midst of what would later be described as a bipolar episode, but she had a not very well documented history of mental illness, and she herself was concerned about her own mental well-being. But there was a big effort on part of the sheriff's department initially to downplay any indications that my Teresa was mentally ill at the time, because that would have put their decision to release her in such a fashion in even worse, a worse light. And that could have been illegal, potentially, I think. So they chose not to put her on a psychiatric hold. So they were then sort of at pains to say, oh no, she seemed really fine. You know, there was nothing wrong with her, but it did come out that she was not fine at all. And she had not slept or eaten really for days leading up to this episode at Joffrey's. And her odd conversations that she was having were kind of part of this breakdown that she was in the middle of. But in any case, so Mytrice could potentially have walked to Montanito, and she was seen in a backyard there around 6:30 in the morning. And the owners of the home where she was actually called law enforcement. They called the sheriff's department and they said, there's a prowler. And so when Mytrice's mother called the station back and learned that her daughter was no longer there, somebody figured out, oh, wait a minute, we got a report of someone who sort of sounds like the description of Mytrice Richardson. And they told her, they told Latisse, oh, your daughter, go, you know, we think she's in Montanito. She's over there probably with some friends or something like that. And so that seemed absolutely unbelievable to Latisse Sutton, Mytrice's mother. She did not have friends in Montanito, but that's basically, you know, her next move was to file a missing persons report and try to start putting some pressure on law enforcement to find her daughter.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear these messages.
Walmart has Straight Talk Wireless, so I can keep doing me, like hitting up all my friends for a last minute study sesh, or curating the best pop playlist you've ever heard in your life, and even editing all my socials to keep up with what's new. Oh yeah, I look good. Post it. Which all in all suits my study poppy main character vibes to a T, period. Find and shop your fave tech at Walmart.
It's time to have your high five moment with High Five Casino, the top social casino where the action and real prizes never stop. Fun spins and big wins are right at your fingertips with over 1,000 games, including High Five Casino exclusives. High Five Casino is always free to play with free coins given out every 4 hours. Sign up today for a free welcome offer that can get you spinning and winning right away. Visit highfivecasino.com.
High Five Casino.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. Must be 21 years or older. Terms and conditions apply.
Summer is supposed to be an opportunity to slow down, but when you look at your kids, you can't help but notice that your kids are growing up fast. Help them build independence as they grow with Greenlight. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families, where parents can keep an eye on kids' money habits, while kids learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely. It's the easy, convenient way to raise financially smart kids. Get your first month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
At Ashley, you'll find colorful furniture that brings your home to life. Ashley makes it easier than ever to express your personal style with an array of looks in fun, trending hues to choose from earth tones to vibrant colors to calming blues and greens. Ashley has pieces for every room in the house in the season's most sought-after shades. A more colorful life starts at Ashley. Shop in-store, online today. Ashley, for the love of home.
Now, you were talking about Latisse putting some pressure on police to find out more about the disappearance of her daughter. Tell us how she does that.
So she actually had to go to LAPD because Mytrice was a resident of the city of LA, and that's how missing persons cases are conducted. They're conducted by the law enforcement agency in the area where the missing person lives. So LAPD collaborated with the sheriff's department because they didn't really know much about rural Malibu. And this area, you've got a picture, this is not, you know, oceanfront Malibu. This is in the heart of the Santa Monica Mountains. It's incredibly rural. There are mountain lions. Montanito is dark sky community, so there are not even streetlights out there. And it's actually really easy to get lost in a place like that. And so the Lost Hill Station has a well-known search and rescue group, and they started to conduct the searches. And they went first to that house in Montanito where Maitrice had last been seen. And they found her footsteps in going down into the backyard of the couple who had called law enforcement saying there was a prowler, and going out to the front of the house. And then the footprints, they couldn't find any other footprints near there, but they brought in some dogs, and the dogs sniffed Maitrice's scent, and it led them to the house next door. They searched that house. There was no sign of her there. And they really didn't know at first. They were assuming that they were looking for somebody who was lost, who might be seeking help, who might be going house to house, who might be hungry, thirsty, or they didn't really know. But then the information started to come from Maitrice's family and some of her friends that actually maybe she wasn't in her right mental state. She was in some kind of elevated state. She was not acting like herself, basically. So eventually law enforcement really started looking for a suicide. They were looking at the bottom of cliffs for thinking maybe she had jumped. They started to really conceive of this case quite differently as a disappearance due to a suicide. And 11 months passed. And then one day, a group of rangers who were searching for a marijuana grow, because that's another thing that happens out in these rural Santa Monica mountains, especially back then, there were some very large marijuana operations. There were also some smaller, kind of more cottage industry type of operations, but these rangers had disrupted a grow a year earlier before Maitrice would have been there. And they went back to check whether the people operating the grow had started up again. And they found her remains. And what they found was kind of, in a sense, where my starting point is as a reporter. And Haley Fox and I just talked endlessly about this scenario that I'm about to describe to you. So Maitrice's remains were skeletonized. They're almost a complete skeleton, but naked. Her jeans and her belt and her bra were found separate from her body. The belt was off the jeans. Her shirt, her underwear, if she was wearing them, her shoes, those items were never found. And Maitrice's remains were also partially mummified, which led to a lot of different speculation about, you know, where she had died and what had happened to her. But basically, at that point, it became a coroner's case. And it turns into, I said that there's a lot of, you know, different agencies involved and a lot of kind of overlap. So at that point, it becomes a sheriff's department homicide case, because now the body has been found and it's in the sheriff's department's jurisdiction, and a coroner case. And there's a big dispute between the coroner and the sheriff's department, which I can get into if you're interested. But the bottom line was, we talked to the forensic pathologist who conducted the autopsy, and she said there was no evidence of trauma on the bones. So they could not classify this as a homicide. It was an undetermined cause of death. It was not, obviously, it wasn't, there was nothing to indicate a suicide. There was nothing to prove that it was a natural cause, that there were natural causes. There was not enough soft tissue to do any kind of rape kit or sexual assault assessment. There was not enough soft tissue to do a thorough toxicology. You know, they really couldn't determine anything. They didn't know if it was an overdose, a suicide, a death from exposure, a death from snake bite, or a homicide. But if it was a homicide, it was one that didn't leave any marks on the remains that were found. And that was just, you know, that was the place that basically the story got left by law enforcement, which is they said, well, everything we've come to learn about her suggests that she was in the midst of a mental health crisis and wandered up into this canyon and died. And Haley and I just could not believe that she had taken off her own clothes and just sat down and willed herself to death. And meanwhile, where were the rest of her clothes?
Now tell us about the person that you spoke to, the Karen Smith, and the person that reported seeing her at 6:30 a.m. outside her home and speaking with her. So tell us about that interview and this person you title Lifelong Montanito.
Oh, president. Yeah, the Montanito lifer. Well, one thing that we learned was that there was the Karen Smith story, which Karen Smith lived at the house where Maitrice was seen at 6:30 in the morning in Montanito. It's sort of known in the neighborhood as the tennis court house because there aren't a lot of tennis courts, but they've got one. And Karen Smith she and her husband called law enforcement about seeing Maitrice in the backyard. Her story was very simple. It was just she woke up, she saw this woman in the backyard, she called down, do you need any help? The woman, who everybody understands to be Maitrice, responded, no, I'm just resting. And then by the time she looked out the window again, Maitrice was gone. And the footprints that were found there were Vans shoe prints in the size that Maitrice wore, and she was wearing Vans that night. And basically, they were seen running around to the side, to the front of the house. And then those no more Vans footprints were seen near the tennis court house. So that was Karen Smith's story. Very simple and very basic. Now, later, this is 2009, September 2009, when Karen Smith tells that story. Several years later, somebody else told a different story about seeing Maitrice at around 4:30 in the morning. And this person, who I call the Montanito lifer, he said that she was in an altercation with somebody possibly inside the house, and that she was very upset and she was yelling in front of the house. And that story created a kind of problem in the narrative. So was she outside the house at 4:30 a.m. having an altercation, or was she in the backyard at 6:30 a.m. having just, you know, taken a little rest? And Karen Smith said she didn't know anything about shouting at 4:30 in the morning. And so there was a problem with this timeline. And that also became central to our inquiry and our resolution that we brought this case to, because we think that we know who harmed Maitrice.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear from our sponsor. You know, we all should trust our gut instincts when it comes to eating properly and exercising, but when we don't, these and other factors can throw off our gut microbiome. So Ritual created a 3-in-1 supplement with clinically studied prebiotics, probiotics, and a postbiotic to support a balanced gut microbiome. I've been taking Ritual's multivitamins for years now, and when Symbiotic Plus became available, I immediately began taking it every morning. I trust the research Ritual has conducted. Recently, I've added Ritual's stress relief to my daily routine. Daily 3-in-1 prebiotic, probiotic, and postbiotic with two of the world's most clinically studied probiotic strains to support the relief of mild and occasional bloating, gas, and diarrhea. Postbiotics provide fuel to the cells that make up the gut lining to support a healthy gut barrier. There's no more shame in your gut game. Symbiotic Plus and Ritual are here to celebrate, not hide, your insides. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/murder. Start Ritual or add Symbiotic Plus to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/murder for 25% off. Now, how do you continue? This podcast series has a numerous interviews. So the information you get from Karen Smith and then from the lifer, as you say, what does that lead you to do next? And who do you want to speak with specifically?
Well, we needed to figure out who this lifer was and why he was, was he credible and why he told this story. And one of the things that was a great benefit of having been reporting in Malibu for so many years already at this point was that I had established some trust with, in particular, a sergeant in Malibu who worked for search and rescue. And he was deeply involved in the Malibu Creek State Park case. And season one of the podcast was about his efforts to solve that case. In part, it was also about the way in which he was stymied and blocked by his own law enforcement organization from solving it. But in the end, he did, with a lot of help from a lot of other people too, but he had played an instrumental role. And we kept in touch, and I knew that the Maitrice case really bothered him. And he had conducted many of the searches because he was the person in charge of the search and rescue team. And he cared deeply about the case. And he was really troubled that they hadn't been able to solve it. So he retired. And, you know, by the time I had all these conversations with him, he was retired. And he eventually told me a piece of information that would open up the entire story for Haley and me. And that was that there had been a person of interest that the sheriff's department looked at. So when we got that information, we learned everything we possibly could about that person, and quite a lot that law enforcement never found out, because people were willing to talk to us all these years later who, you know, maybe law enforcement had never contacted, or maybe they hadn't said certain things to law enforcement that they said to us. I don't really know, but we were able to develop, I think, a very compelling case for this person's involvement.
Tell us about that investigation and where the investigation seemed to end for police.
Well, it was strange because there were rumors in Montecito as soon as Maitrice went missing about this individual who might have been involved. Somebody tipped law enforcement and said, go check this guy out. And they did do a, they checked the place that he lived. And there was actually a rumor that there might be human remains. So this was before Maitrice's remains were found during the 11 months when they were searching for her. And Malibu Search and Rescue was pursuing all kinds of leads at that point. You know, all the time people were saying that they'd seen her, they'd saw human remains, or they saw a blood stain. And, you know, so they were chasing down everything because everybody wanted to find out where she was. And so this was during that time when, before the human remains found, they went to see if there were in fact human remains at the place where this person was. And they determined, nope, those aren't human remains. And therefore, that person kind of got checked off the list in a sense. And then the rumors about this person persisted. And eventually they surfaced again. And he was actually questioned. And they, law enforcement, this is now the Homicide Bureau of the Sheriff's Department, not the search and rescue people. The homicide detectives, they believed his story. And that's one of the things that I find the most unbelievable about this whole entire narrative, is that somehow they took the word of someone who had a history of violence against women, who had a history of violence against law enforcement, who had a history of drug use, had been to prison for attacking women. And they took his word.
Wasn't, though, to be fair with police, wasn't he administered a polygraph exam and passed with flying colors, apparently?
Well, that is what we heard. But polygraph, you know, that's not even, it's basically an investigative tool. It's not determinative.
Right. Yes.
Usually the way law enforcement will use a polygraph is to determine whether they should take a closer look at someone.
Right.
This person, from everything I've been able to learn, they had already sort of said, oh, no, we already looked at him and didn't turn out to be human remains where he was living. So therefore, he couldn't have done this, which, you know, to me, that just doesn't make sense. But it's my big question to the sheriff's department is, why'd you let him go? And how could you be so sure when there was so much to suggest, so much circumstantial evidence to suggest that he was involved? Why would you let him walk? But they've never answered that question. And Haley and I discovered quite a bit of additional circumstantial evidence and have tried to present it to the sheriff's department repeatedly, and they don't seem interested. And we even found what could be direct forensic evidence that we don't have the resources to analyze fully and say whether or not there's a direct connection between Maitreese and this person and this location. Sheriff's Department has those resources, but they won't even call us back.
You talked about violence to women. That's one thing, but this is more specific in terms of examples of parallels with his violence with these women, because you talk to witnesses that talk about his romance with this woman named Darian, and he goes and does 3 years in prison for assaulting her, but other women that were specifically threatened with their life.
We talked to somebody that he strangled, and she thought she was going to die. He had her on the ground, according to her, strangling her, punching her, and she thought she was going to die. And the interesting thing about Maitreese's remains, I said it was a nearly intact human skeleton, but there were a few bones missing. And
yes,
one of the missing bones is the hyoid bone, which is a three-part floating bone in the larynx that is often broken when somebody is strangled. Now, strangulation can be a very hard to prove forensically, but one clear sign of it is when the hyoid is broken. You can be strangled and the hyoid doesn't break. There's not too many other good reasons for the hyoid to break, but it is a very small, very light composite bone, and that was never found. Now, I'm not suggesting that a killer would have been, that this person who I think harmed Maitreese would have been clever enough to, or skilled enough to remove the hyoid bone that was broken. I just think it's another terrible coincidence in this case that that bone is missing. But look, they could have had that knowledge. But what we do know is that this person had a history of violence against women, of going to prison for violence against women, and of strangling women.
You also talk about the kinds of drugs, and the particular drug that seemed very interesting to me, given his strange behavior as witnessed by even his own friends, especially near the end of is that he was a user of PCP, among other drugs, and also explain the proximity and the role of the grow op in this story and his fort that he had built.
Yeah. So, well, this person had a long standing relationship with drugs, and starting in his teenage years from many conversations with his friends and the social history that Haley and I were able to build around him, understanding who he was. So PCP starting in the 70s, at least in the 70s. And then, you know, by his later years, and we're talking this period of time, 2009, 10, 11, 12, heavy meth use, but he was a heavy drinker his whole life, many DUIs and, you know, many experiences attacking law enforcement even. So he had a very troubled past, I would say. He had come back to Montecito after being released from prison for the incident that you mentioned, where he was incarcerated for his assault of his then girlfriend. He came back to his home community of Montecito and he was kind of couch surfing with loyal friends, but he also built himself a kind of off the grid fort. And just a, you know, about a mile up the road above Montecito into the mountains, just off the road, the brush is so dense that you just go 5 feet off the road and you're in the middle of nowhere. So he had a spot there that he liked to hang out. And then not very far from there, over the other side of the road and, you know, cross some private property and then plunge down into a place called Dark Canyon. And that's where there were some big grow operations, apparently, that the Rangers were checking on. But it's also a place where this guy had, since the 70s, since he was a young man, had been growing marijuana. So this area, Dark Canyon, it's a slot canyon. It's very, very difficult to access unless you know the right little trail. This guy did. And he tried to take a bunch of women after Maitrice to show them where he grew pot and or where Maitrice's remains were. So this is somebody who was basically playing tour guide about Maitrice's remains spot to a lot of people. And I think that's also pretty suspicious and strange. And at a time when it's not clear to me how he would have known exactly where her remains were found. So he knew how to get in there. He had been growing pot in there. He also grew pot at his little fort, but Maitrice, one thing was that she actually really liked pot. That was kind of her drug of choice. So you can easily imagine a scenario where he said to her, hey, I'm going to show you, I've got the best plants. Come with me. Something went wrong, you know, or we don't know if he, you know, we can't say for sure. Like, was this intentional? Was there an accident? And he was recently, you know, he was on parole. There was not an easy path for him to say, you know, I didn't do it, but this young woman fell and hit her head and died while she was with me, or overdosed, or, you know, he was terrified of going back to prison. Many of his friends told us that. Many of his friends who had really good reason to suspect him of being involved. So that's what we drew out in our story, was basically all the knowledge that's been stored in the minds of these people and on the consciences of these people who knew this man, things that they didn't ever tell each other or tell law enforcement. And we drew from that and drew that out and painted a portrait that I think, even if law enforcement won't listen to us or take up what we learned and go with it and actually lay this case to rest, which they should do for Maitrice's family and Maitrice, even if they won't do that, we feel that we have shed light on how she came to be in that canyon.
Let's use this as an opportunity to hear these messages.
Walmart has Straight Talk Wireless, so I can keep doing me, like hitting up all my friends for a last-minute study sesh, or curating the best pop playlist you've ever heard in your life, and even editing all my socials to keep up with what's new. Oh yeah, I look good. Post it. Which all in all suits my study poppy main character vibes to a T, period. Find and shop your fave tech at Walmart.
It's time to have your high five moment with High Five Casino, the top social casino where the action and real prizes never stop. Fun spins and big wins are right at your fingertips with over 1,000 games, including High Five Casino exclusives. High Five Casino is always free to play with free coins given out every 4 hours. Sign up today for a free welcome offer that can get you spinning and winning right away. Visit highfivecasino.com.
High Five Casino.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. Must be 21 years or older. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list: teaching your kids about money.
With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then, learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
At Ashley, you'll find colorful furniture that brings your home to life. Ashley makes it easier than ever to express your personal style with an array of looks in fun, trending hues to choose from earth tones to vibrant colors to calming blues and greens. Ashley has pieces for every room in the house in the season's most sought-after shades. A more colorful life starts at Ashley. Shop in-store, online today. Ashley, for the love of home.
Now, one of the very, very compelling things that you have discovered is that apparently Rick Forsberg, who's now deceased, by the way, is that he told somebody that he encountered Matrice, or he saw Matrice that evening, September 16th. Tell us about this discovery and this witness.
Well, we decided that we would talk to as many of his old friends from the neighborhood as we could. And we found a woman who had known him quite well and whose house he went to directly from Lost Hill Station after his polygraph. And she described his mannerisms, his behavior. He was sweating, he was pacing, he was running his hands through his hair. And she said he was trying to confess to her. She didn't know exactly what, but she stopped him. She didn't want to hear. She didn't want to have to turn him in. And this neighborhood connection and bond goes very deep with these people. But this is back then, back in around 2012. This is what she was saying. Rick, stop telling me, stop talking. I don't want to hear it. But before she silenced him, he did manage to tell her that he had picked Maitrice up on his motorcycle. So that's something that he sure didn't tell law enforcement that. I can't imagine they could have let him walk if he had told them that. That to me is a pretty good indicator that he lied in his polygraph. And once he picked her up, where did they go? Did they go to the fort? Well, we were looking for evidence at this fort that would connect to Maitrice. We were looking for items of hers that were never found. And we found a lot of women's underwear at that fort. And this is what we got some of it tested, but it's incredibly expensive to do private lab DNA testing. And this is where we're begging the sheriff's department to pick up where we had to leave off and actually test all of this underwear. Why did he have ladies' underwear in many different sizes up there? Whose belongings are these? You know, some of them we think we understand who they might belong to, but others, you know, it's all different styles and sizes. And it's, you know, the idea that one of these could be Maitrice, that could solve this case, but we don't know.
Why would you contend, or why do you contend, that the sheriff's department might not be as interested as you and in finding a conclusion contrary to what they theorized many years ago?
This case has been a total nightmare for them from start to finish. That they arrested her under the circumstances that they did, that they released her the way that they did, that her remains weren't found for almost a year. There are so many ways in which they would just like this to go away. I forever believe in the good intentions of people, especially people whose jobs are to serve the public, like law enforcement. And I keep thinking someone will want to be a hero, but the detectives who investigated the case, I have no reason to think that they're anything but good honest, earnest investigators, but they certainly stopped short of where I would have stopped if I were in their shoes. And I can't really do anything else other than speculate about why. And that's not really fair to do. I can only just sort of, what feels like the right thing to do is to point at, look, there were things that you guys didn't know back then, things you didn't find. Why they didn't go to his fort again, I have no idea. But they didn't. And this stuff was still there. And Haley and I found it. And they should just take it now. And someone should be a hero. But I don't know why they don't.
Is it something to do with what Lisa Scheinen was involved with the second autopsy and still finding no sign of trauma? So is that a police out? Is that an out for police saying that it's still undetermined? So,
yeah, well, look, if this was a cold case homicide, it would be different. It would be somebody's a major feather in their cap to solve it.
Right.
My Teresa's case is in a kind of limbo because it's not technically a homicide. So first you have to have a reason to recategorize this as a homicide. And then you have to have someone say, oh, my predecessors, most of those detectives who worked on the case are retired now, if not all of them. They were great guys, but they weren't as thorough, or they weren't as determined, or they weren't as, I mean, you're kind of criticizing your colleagues, and that's not very comfortable. Sometimes I think there's a big culture of just protecting each other from that. Yeah. I mean, I think that many people believed that her mental health explained her death. And this mental health episode she was in the midst of became the explanation. And what we said in many off the record conversations with law enforcement was, can't you see how her mental state, her state of mind on September 17th, 2009, made her more vulnerable to a predator?
Yes.
It's not an either or. It's not she was mentally ill or she was the victim of a predator. Why can't you embrace the idea that it was both?
You research personally the possibility of her just wandering into this canyon and getting to where police say that she ended up.
Yeah, that's a big no way. There is no way Maitreese got in there by herself. She either went in there with someone who knew how to get in there, or somebody dumped her remains there. So you cannot imagine the motivation for someone to go on these, we don't know the trail. Someone probably knows the trail. We don't know the trail. You can walk up a creek bed. It's filled with boulders. At one point you get to basically a sheer rock wall that you need to belay up. And she wasn't a woodsy girl, according to her family. She's a city girl. She grew up in the suburbs mostly, actually. And she was just not going to go hiking in her vans, in the middle of the night or at any time. And it just defies logic, honestly. So we tried to go in from the bottom. We tried to go in from the top. We tried to go in from the side. There's not really, if you ever attempted any of these things, you would see there's no reason for her to go there. And she wouldn't. And she probably couldn't, unless someone was pushing her up over these or helping her down these steep canyon walls. It's just not a walk in the park, and there's no reason she would have gone there.
Is part of this, you believe that the police are resistant to, again, solve this case in say the way that you have unfolded it, in that they they would be even more responsible than they already receive criticism for not conducting a 51-50, which police say was a possibility. People know that somebody in mental stress, that a 51-50 would be issued. So do you believe that maybe they don't want to be responsible, liable for what they did that night?
Right. Well, I see what you're saying. You know, if she was killed, it would re-inflame the public anger about their release of her. But you know what? That public anger is already very much a factor and has been. So what has happened is that there are just rampant conspiracy theories about law enforcement involvement with her death. And we researched that angle very hard, and we did not find anything that was persuasive to us that law enforcement was involved in her death. We found a lot to persuade us that law enforcement could have solved her death and didn't, stop short of it. And maybe you're right. Maybe it makes it worse in their minds, you know, the optics of it if she was killed. But everybody now thinks that she was killed and that a cop killed her. So I think that they could be a redemption story.
What we haven't spoken about, and this is a very incredible aspect of this podcast, in that you were able to, the Matrice's journals, she was a big journaler, and their journals were found in her car by police. You were able to get four of those journals from Michael Richardson, Matrice's father, and you have incorporated them in a couple of the episodes to show exactly the personality of Matrice, but also her descent into mental illness.
Yes, we were so fortunate that Michael trusted us with those journals, and extremely grateful to him that we were the first people who had been granted access to them. And a really important part of the story for Haley and me was allowing Matrice the person to come through. So often once someone becomes a victim, their identity shrinks down to just that one word. And we really wanted this wonderful human being to have a real presence in our story, and the journals were the perfect way to do it. We got an actor to read her part, and I think it really, I hope that it motivates people who listen to think about and feel more passionate about seeking justice for this actual young woman, Matrice Richardson. It was very evident reading the journals that she was spiraling and struggling and really suffering. And we were looking at the journals also for clues, you know, long before we had this kind of, as we were building our case against this person that we think was involved with her death, we were also looking at the possibility that, you know, something else might have happened. And the journals were a big resource for us looking for clues, but also who should we be talking to about her? Who knew what was going on? And it helped us piece together a lot, having that insight into her life. So that was really, really important for us.
Tell us a little bit more about the Lost Hill podcast. We discussed probably up to the latest episode, which was episode 10. Tell us about the episodes that are involved in season 4. And also tell us about who writes and hosts this, and who was it reported by, and who is the co-creator of Lost Hills?
Okay, I'll tell you everything. So I co-created Lost Hills with Ben Adair, and we started, this is the fourth season of the show. The first season was about the murder in the campground in Malibu Creek State Park. And I'm the host and I write the podcast. And this season, season 4, I co-reported with Haley Fox, who's also a senior producer on this season and who Haley has worked with me on all the seasons of the show. So she is an integral part of the Lost Hills world. And it is a world. The crime and law enforcement in Malibu is its own special world. And yeah, it was really great to be working with people who had that kind of history with the show, you know, had been working on it since the beginning. So there are a lot of interconnections among the different seasons. You know, like I mentioned, Sergeant Wright, who helped us break through with season four, had been a really important part of season one. So, you know, they're just, it's a small world out there, but a lot of really wild stuff happens. So it turns out to be a pretty interesting beat.
Right. Now tell us about Lost Hills Dark Canyon, when the next episode drops.
Well, our episodes come out on Mondays and Wednesdays. So if this is coming out on, does this come, this, our podcast that we're doing right now comes out today?
It comes out Monday. It comes out Monday.
Okay. So the next episode is coming out today, which is Monday. Well, you guys are hearing this Monday, July 15th. So yeah, that's when our episodes drop. But anyone who gets excited about getting to the end of it can subscribe to Pushkin Plus on the Apple Podcast page, and you can binge the whole season ad-free right now if you want to. But also, I should mention that you can follow us at Lost Hills Pod, and you can find all the episodes on the Lost Hills Show page on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and talking about season four, Dark Canyon, of your hit podcast, Lost Hills. Thank you so much for this interview, and you have a great evening. Dana Goodyear.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Really appreciate you doing this and taking the time.
Thank you, and have a good night.
All right. Take care.
My Keurig brewer from Walmart always comes in super clutch. I got it so I can keep grinding on my paper. You know I'm hitting that deadline. I also got it so I could stay up late to do some exam cramming. And of course, you know I'll be ready to stroll into my morning class, sipping in style. I guess you could say it's a literal lifesaver. Cheers to that. Shop your coffee fuel needs at Walmart.
High Five Casino lets you play your favorite slot and live table games, like blackjack, with the chance to redeem for real cash prizes. High Five Casino has a giant selection of over 1,200 games, including hundreds of exclusive games only found on High Five Casino. It's always free to play, and free coins are given out every 4 hours. Ready to have your own High Five moment? Visit HighFiveCasino.com. That's high, the number five, casino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. Must be 21 years or older. Terms and conditions apply.
Summer is supposed to be an opportunity to slow down. But when you look at your kids, you can't help but notice that your kids are growing up fast. Help them build independence as they grow with Greenlight. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families, where parents can keep an eye on kids' money habits while kids learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely. It's the easy, convenient way to raise financially smart kids. Get your first month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
At Ashley, you'll find colorful furniture that brings your home to life. Ashley makes it easier than ever to express your personal style with an array of looks in fun, trending hues to choose from earth tones to vibrant colors to calming blues and greens. Ashley has pieces for every room in the house in the season's most sought-after shades. A more colorful life starts at Ashley. Shop in-store, online today. Ashley, for the love of home.